Let's look first of all at Haggai. Okay? Haggai begins his preaching around 520 BC and prophesies for 4 months. So this is about 12 years after the foundation of the temple has been laid and nothing's happened. It's all been stalled. The reason for the stall is because some of the surrounding peoples, neighboring but adversarial people, have threatened to take action if they build the temple any further. Okay? And the two main antagonists are Sanballat, okay, and he's the governor, if you will, of Samaria, and Tobiah, who's the governor of the Transjordan. Whoops. Okay, so Samaria here will be what used to be the northern kingdom, which had its capital at Samaria. And so that will be north of Judah, and the Transjordan will be that across the Jordan River to the east of Jordan. Okay, and originally what you have are these governors and their representatives, especially Sanballat, coming and saying, welcome back to the territory. We're glad to have you here. And you're going to build the temple. Let us help you build it. And then we can come and worship here as well, because we've been worshiping the true God ever since the Assyrians brought us here. Okay? So this is the these are the descendants of the people who are brought in after the Assyrian conquest, and they say, we've been worshiping the same God as you. Well, have they been? No, they've been worshiping all kinds of syncretistic gods and so forth. Yeah, Yahweh is one of many of them, and so they're saying, we'll come and be a part of this. And Zerubbabel says, no way, no can do. We will do it ourselves, and we have the edict here from the Persian emperor that we are to do it, so we'll build the temple. This will be our temple. You mind your own ways of worshiping and so forth. And so this sets up the antagonism, which continues even to the first century. We read about it in the Gospels, of the antagonism between the Jews and the Samaritans, okay, and their different approaches to worship. You think of John 4, the woman, Samaritan woman at the well. Now, that's the first question she asks is, well, what's the right way to worship? Is it to worship in Jerusalem, like the Jews say, or to worship up here in our territory, Mount Gerizim? So this then puts bad blood immediately from the very beginning, and these two nearby leaders stand in opposition to the continued construction of the temple. The problem with the people, though, is that they should have just moved ahead anyway, plowed ahead, trusted the Lord. He had brought them back, but now they become fearful, and everything comes to a standstill in terms of the building of the temple. Now, they're building everything else. They're building their own homes. And this is part of the criticism that Haggai has then. He arouses these Jews from their lethargy. Okay? And in chapter 1, he uses some sarcasm. His message has bite and fire to it. It's what we as Lutherans would label as law, as judgment, as criticism upon the people. It's kind of a cattle prod that he uses here. exhorting the complacent Jews to rebuild the temple. And essentially what he says is, look around. All around here you've got your homes that you live in. They've all been restored. Some of you are living in mansions. And yet the Lord's house, Yahweh's house, lies in shambles. Is still not built. And so that criticism. Finally then, through the influence of Haggai, and as we'll see here, Zechariah, the people do start rebuilding, but some of them are discouraged because when they see the layout and kind of as things are being built, they recognize this is not going to be anything like the temple that Solomon had built. It's not going to hold a candle to the glory and the majesty of that previous temple. And so they become discouraged. And thus, now the prophet Haggai, in chapter 2, provides comfort to them, comfort to the despondent, with the promise of a greater temple. Not the temple they are building, but he says there will come a greater temple, a more spectacular temple that the Lord will fill. And I guess that is literally fulfilled in the temple that Herod builds, which becomes the jewel of the Middle East during the time of Jesus himself, but then to be destroyed by the Romans. Quite a magnificent structure. But really, we as Christians would understand him to be referring to the temple in the flesh of the Messiah. Okay. And this is very clear, particularly in the Gospel of John, that Jesus is the temple. He replaces the physical building because this is now where God's presence is most fully demonstrated to bring blessing to his people. So it is a very kind of cryptic messianic prophecy. Okay, also in chapter 2, Haggai makes promises to Zerubbabel. Okay, remember, Zerubbabel is of the Davidic line. So this is really a promise, not just to an individual, but to the Davidic dynasty, the house of David as well. More gospel material here. And the promises here are the prosperity and the dominion of Zerubbabel and thus this Davidic line, which again is a cryptic way of looking forward to the ultimate reign of the Messiah, of the Son of David in this line. Okay, so these are some characteristics, but it's important for you to realize that both Haggai and, as we'll see, Zechariah as well, will specifically speak oracles about Zerubbabel and the hope that is in Zerubbabel, but especially in Zerubbabel being of the line of David, the reestablishment of that Davidic line. Okay, let's talk now about Zechariah. Zechariah begins his preaching around 520 BC, prophesies for at least 4 years till the dedication of the new temple in 516. However, the final portion of his prophecy, which is very different from the first part, the final portion, chapters 9 through 14, may have been delivered later, even after 480 BC. We just don't know. There's no real historical connecting points for us with that latter material. The first part of Zechariah, chapters 1 through 8, very similar message as we saw with Haggai. The focus is on completing the rebuilding of the temple. So the same purpose as Haggai had, encouraging, challenging, exhorting the people to rebuild that temple. And he also throws his weight behind Zerubbabel. Well, really, Yahweh does, because as a prophet, he's the mouthpiece of the Lord. So Yahweh is endorsing, supporting Zerubbabel in this task. And again, there's not only a support of Zerubbabel as a person, but also the office he fills, that is, of the line of David. It's again God's attestation that he will hold true to his promise to David and the Davidic dynasty of that covenant with David. But he also calls the people to spiritual renewal. Not just the physical rebuilding of the temple, but a renewing of the spirit. That's what's been hindering them from rebuilding the temple. So it's a focus upon their faith, the renewal of their faith. Okay, so that's the first part, which really is focused on this historical setting of the building of the temple. The second part, chapters 9 through 14, however, are very different. And these are a series of apocalyptic prophecies. And if you remember, apocalyptic literature, as we saw yesterday, does not so much focus on the call to repentance as it looks ahead to the hope of the Messiah and the Messianic Kingdom. And it usually does so with very, very symbolic imagery. We saw that with Ezekiel. We saw it with Daniel, those latter chapters. Now we see more apocalyptic literature here in chapters 9 to 14, focusing primarily on the coming kingdom of the Messiah, the Messianic age. Thus, Zechariah has oftentimes been called the Passion Week prophet because his prophecies are the ones that are frequently quoted in the Gospels by the Gospel writers during Passion Week as being fulfilled in the events that take place in Holy Week. So he's oftentimes called then the Holy Week prophet. And he's got prophecies that relate to Christ's advent, also to the reception of the Messiah. But interestingly enough, he has many prophecies about the rejection of the Messiah, of how the Messiah will be rejected. And so it's not simply Isaiah who speaks of a rejected Messiah, a suffering and dying Messiah, but Zechariah does as well, and it's in these chapters. Okay, so there are a number of these that are quoted then in the Gospel writers during Passion Week. We'll look at two of them, but for example, he speaks proleptically here, looking ahead to the Palm Sunday event, to the cleansing of the temple. For example, when Jesus drives out the money changers, the gospel writer says this was to fulfill what the prophet said, zeal for my house has consumed him. Okay, that's from Zechariah. The smitten shepherd, when Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane and the disciples scatter. Well, that's a fulfillment here of Zechariah's, the shepherd shall be smitten and the sheep shall scatter. And then also when Jesus is dead on the cross and the Roman soldier thrusts the spear into his side, okay, and then it's a reference is made here to Zechariah that they will look upon the one that they have pierced. So a number of these, but two that you need to know for the exam, or one of the versions of the exam, depending on which version you get here, is this one that then is cited at the Palm Sunday event in Zechariah 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Okay? So this comes from Zechariah. And it's important for you to recognize the source of this from the Passion Week prophet. You should be able to make the association. Okay, this is an event of the Passion Week, Jesus Palm Sunday. So think of the Passion Week prophet. The other passage that is associated here is that with Judas's betrayal. And this is also quoted then in the New Testament by the gospel writers. From Zechariah 11, they paid me 30 pieces of silver, and the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord to the potter. And so it's the betrayal. Judas betrays Jesus for the 30 pieces of silver, but then has remorse, returns to the temple. The authorities won't take back the money, so he throws it into the temple. And they use that money then to buy the field where Judas was buried, which is the potter's field. So those connections are made there. Okay, and then finally, through the influence of these prophets, the temple is completed and dedicated in 516 BC. And this is described in chapter 6, beginning with verse 13, the dedication, the celebration of Passover, and it's a time of great rejoicing. For now, not only have the people resettled the land, but the temple has been rebuilt, the dwelling place of Yahweh in their midst. Okay. Well, maybe let's just pause there. Any questions or comments about what we've covered thus far? Okay, then the second migration takes place about 558 BC, and this is the return under Ezra the priest. The first migration, approximately 50,000 people came. This second migration is kind of reinforcements, a much smaller number. We're told about 1,500 Jews came. Okay? And Ezra is actually commissioned by Artaxerxes, the Persian emperor here, to go and investigate the land of Judah. Artaxerxes recognizes Ezra as a capable person who's a Jew, devoted to the Jewish people, and so he sends him now to investigate. And he is to take a significant community, 1,500 people. That's a pretty significant community to migrate for something like this kind of commission. And then also much financial support and resources for that. Okay. Ezra then arrives in Jerusalem in 458. We'll see that Nehemiah will arrive 13 years later in 445 or 444. So in the traditional chronology, Ezra comes first. And that's the chronology we're using here. So, what happens here? When Ezra arrives, he finds that the people are in significant spiritual ignorance. And so he gives kind of a grade of a F for the spiritual life of the people there. And remember that this is significantly after the building of the temple, 50, 60 some years. And so the people now have become pretty complacent in terms of obedience to God's law. So what he does is he begins to teach them. And as I said before, Ezra is the teacher, the catechist. He It begins at the very basics with the teaching of the scriptures, the exposition of the Torah. And he teaches them. And as the people now are being taught and hear of the covenant, and they see the mirror of God's law, and they look at themselves in that mirror, they see how far they've fallen short. And they confess their sin and agree to obey Yahweh's covenant. A particular issue that becomes very, very evident is that of mixed marriages, that in these 60 years or so, they have begun to do what had brought the people down before, associating, integrating with foreigners who bring their gods and goddesses along with them and actually marrying them in the marriage covenant. And so they recognize that this has happened and this is a violation of the Lord's command. And so the people themselves take the initiative and say, we will dissolve these marriages. Ezra himself does not prescribe this. They respond this way, but Ezra says he gives his sanction to it. And it's especially the leaders, many of the officials, who have married foreign wives. And those mixed marriages then are dissolved for the sake of the purity of the people now. And remember, in the post-exilic period now, the emphasis will be, let's not make the same mistakes that our forebears did that brought about the exile. And so they take this much more seriously when it is brought to their attention. And here Ezra brings it to their attention. So what you have then is that the wives and even the children in these mixed marriages are sent away. Okay. Now there's no place specifically where the Bible here in this section necessarily says God ordered this. It doesn't necessarily say that God looked down upon it either. It kind of gives a tacit approval, but it doesn't necessarily say that God ordered this. The one thing that does become clear, though, is that in further revelation in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and 7, where Paul talks about marital relations and so forth, he makes it very clear that if a believer is married to an unbeliever, the believer should not, because on that basis, separate from the unbeliever and divorce or whatever, or desert or leave, that they are to remain in that state, particularly if you've got someone, a pagan couple, and one of them converts. Well, the one who converts to Christianity is not to desert, but is to remain in that marital bond. And the Lord may use that marital bond then and the influence of the believer to bring the other person to faith here as well. So we certainly would not use this as, you know, paradigmatic of the kind of behavior that we have in terms of marriages. However, in the New Testament, it does also say that believers, Christians, are not to be unequally yoked. Okay, now that's broader than just marriage, but there's probably the most significant yoking that you have in human relationships is marriage, and he's speaking about spiritual relationships, your spiritual life. And so, for those of you who are single, who are looking for a spouse, I think the number one criteria, first thing you're looking for is someone who is a Christian, who shares that faith, and can support you, and you can support him or her in your faith walk together and raise children of faith. But if for those who do not find themselves in that situation, it's not automatic then that they have to dissolve that relationship. Okay? Anyone want to respond to that or speak to that issue? Okay, so what we have now, again, in terms of the chronology is the temple's been dedicated here. Ezra comes during Artaxerxes, so let's move him up into this period. And about 13 years later then, Nehemiah comes. Nehemiah has two journeys, but his first journey will be the one which we'll consider then the third migration. This takes place in about 444 BC. Nehemiah originally was the cupbearer to the Persian emperor, Artaxerxes, in the palace in Susa, Persia. We'll see that when we're talking about Esther as well. This is kind of the winter palace where the king would be, spend his time in Susa in Persia. Nehemiah being the cupbearer. What does that say? What's the significance of a cupbearer? Okay. So the cupbearer is really the one who makes sure that whatever drinks and food is brought to the king is safe to be ingested. Okay. So a cupbearer is someone highly trusted, okay, because you have a lot of assassinations that take place through poisoning, particularly if you're familiar with Roman history. I mean, seems like just about every other year you've got an emperor getting poisoned and so forth. So that's an exaggeration, but it's usually by poison that this takes place. And so the cupbearer is the one who assures that the food is safe for the king. Okay, so a highly trusted position. This is Nehemiah's situation. So that's how he starts out, but he will become the governor. Okay, not the king of Judah, but the governor appointed by the emperor himself for that role. Okay, so now we move on to the book of Nehemiah.